Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge. I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital, and I'm joined by Lyndon Robertson, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. Always great to join you, and welcome to all of those that may be joining us on this podcast.
Lyndon and I have both been working on the concept of social capital for a long time, with Lyndon initially approaching it from economics, whereas I came from sociology and social theory. We're both very passionate about the concept, and our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting conversations and engaging debates. In this episode, we'll explore the relationship between the nature of social exchanges and social capital. So, Lyndon, how has your understanding of social capital changed your views of exchanges compared to those that are taught by neoclassical economics?
Great question, Tristan. And I think this is a good starting place because when we talk about how people relate to each other and how we're connected, we often refer to exchanges of goods and services, and we're connected by those exchanges. So as an economist, if I were to view exchanges from an economist's perspective, I think of voluntary exchanges. For example, I enter a store and I have items that I want to purchase. I view the price. I think the good has more value, exceeds the price that I'm asked to give up, and I take the goods to the counter and pay the money and receive the goods. We walk out, the exchange is completed. There No residual, and hopefully the people that sold the goods to me feel benefit from the money they've received, and that I likewise feel like my well-being has improved. I have voluntary exchanges of goods and services. When they're consumables, the transaction is completed at the time of purchase. If they're durables, we may be connected. The buyer and seller may be connected over time as the payments extend for several periods because the services provided by what I buy extend. But that's the extent of the connection we have. So what social capital introduces, at least in my mind, is related to the concept of an externality. And an externality is something that one person does, creates an exchange that either benefits or harms another person without their agreement. So it's not a voluntary exchange, it's I do something. And it creates a benefit or a cost for another. We call that an externality. So this isn't the kind of exchange that we traditionally view and discuss in economic models.
And certainly, if we think about the nature of social exchanges, they're not always voluntary. You know, the assumption that we go into an exchange with the choice as to whether or not we exchange with others isn't always the case. You know, very often people exchange, like effectively exchanges occur involuntarily. You know, an example could be someone pulls a weapon or a gun or a knife and threatens you and forces you into some form of an exchange. But we're talking still about exchanges of commodities. But when we're talking about other types of social exchanges, simply somebody slamming a door is effectively an exchange or creating an externality or however we describe it that is involuntary for everybody around them. They experience that and there's nothing that they can do about it. So I guess the question we're talking about today is what's the nature between social capital and these types of social exchanges?
So another great question, Tristan, and social capital has everything to do with the kinds of externalities people create. For example, you might think of parents who just were successful in putting their child or their children to sleep, and they're careful about creating an externality that might wake the child up again, or wake, or create it, because their relationship to the child and to others is positive. They internalize each other's well-being. So it's hard to for me to imagine, in the example you've described, as somebody pulling a gun on me or some other weapon and saying, "I'm giving you for requiring that you give me your life or your wallet," and I'm going to say to myself, "You really don't have my well-being at heart. My well-being doesn't matter to you. If it did, I doubt you would be requiring this exchange, this externality that you've imposed on me. Would you do it on a family member? Not likely." And so when we create externalities, positive or negative, they're at the heart of them, or is the kind of relationship. Do I have empathy or antipathy for you? Because if I do, they'll probably influence the kind of externalities I create.
And if we take that example of somebody pulling a gun and demanding a wallet, that exchange, somebody giving somebody else some money, it could occur through involuntary means, an involuntary exchange, like we talked about with pulling a gun. Or it could be a voluntary exchange where the person negotiates or discusses or requests the money to be given voluntarily. And even within that voluntary category, perhaps there's coercive types of exchanges where a manipulation or blackmail or something occurs, but there's still an agreement reached. It's still a voluntary exchange, but it's coercive. And those that are purely consensual, where the person happily agrees to give the other person money. And that will occur. Some people will ask for money because they need it, and people will voluntarily agree to do so. Of course, these are three categories that may not be quite so clearly distinct in reality, that it may feel a little bit involuntary, even though you've agreed to do it, or it might feel a little bit coercive, even though you're consenting to do it. So, neat, not necessarily neat categories, but certainly social capital plays a critical role. As you discussed, social capital plays a critical role in this because how we feel about others, how we're connected to others, the empathy that we feel for others is going to influence the nature of the exchange that occurs. You know, like you said, it's hard to imagine that you would pull a gun on your family or a friend or someone you really cared about and had empathy with and enter into an involuntary exchange. Far more likely to hopefully enter into a consensual exchange, maybe coercive, but you know, social capital clearly plays a role.
In fact, someone have described motivations behind exchanges as how you would influence a donkey pulling a cart, holding a carrot in their front, or with a whip or a stick, encouraging them with a stick, or they voluntarily listen to your voice because you have a that kind of a relationship. So there is a spectrum of the kind of motivations that occur in all exchanges. And even in those cases that are coercive, we usually have some choice. Not all the time, but often, as you described, okay, give me your wallet or I shoot you. Okay, I'll give you my wallet. It's the least of too bad. In other cases, you turn up your music very loud. It's disrupting my sleep and my children and other things. I was never consulted. Now I may react in a way, but still, if you didn't care, you would. If you didn't care about the music affecting my children, Or maybe you did, but you had friends visiting, and it was more important to gain their approval than mine. We still have these complicated roles of social capital that are going to influence the nature and the terms of exchanges and the outcome of the exchanges, because we engage in exchanges because we want to satisfy a need. And that's what motivates us. And if there is no relationship, there's unlikely that the need that's going to be satisfied is going to be a social emotional need for validation or belonging or transcendence or so on. It will more likely be the need for commodities. So when a person pulls a weapon on me and says, "Give me your wallet," he's not looking for external validation. He's surely not motivated by desire to join my network or my trend or my or has my altruism at heart.
But of course, those outcomes could be possible from that exchange. You know, they could appeal to the need, and somebody may voluntarily, or perhaps it's coercive, but they may give them money, and there may be an exchange of relational goods. You know, it is a possible outcome of the overall exchange that they're attempting to achieve. But of course, the means by which they chose to engage in that exchange certainly doesn't result in exchange of relational goods. So it sounds like overall what we're saying is that externalities are a part of social exchanges and all forms of exchanges, and that they're regulated by the nature of our relationships.
Exactly. In fact, when we talk about exchanges, we may even think about exchanges with the natural forms of capital. For example, I may be enjoying an outing in the woods and nature and so on, and then I find that someone that preceded me has left their trash and it's sort of diminished my satisfaction. But when they left their trash, supposing that were the case, there was no person for them. They didn't know me, that I might be following them, but still, it was more convenient for them to dispose of it than to pack it out or so on. And in that case, you say, well, what kind of exchange did you have then? Well, we all have some kind of ideal self, some set of behavior that we expect ourselves to comply with. And if in our ideal self, it isn't expected to carry trash out. That's what others are for, or littering the highway or so on. Or painting graffiti on different places. Or if you belong to a network where that is an acceptable behavior, we can get different kind of exchanges where some may not be offended and others clearly are. So again, it's hard to imagine exchanges that rather voluntary or involuntary, or that aren't influenced in some way by social capital.
I think littering is a good example because there has been research done on social capital and littering, and it's the nature of the action, as you pointed out, isn't directly related to other people. You know, it can indirectly affect others, but it's not a direct exchange with others, and so it does bring up the question of, well, is littering an outcome of social capital because of the lack of direct exchange and direct relationship with other people? And clearly, from what we're talking about, the answer is yes. And if you were to ask somebody who throws litter out the window of their vehicle driving down the highway, they would likely say, I don't care. I don't care about others. I don't care that it impacts others, that it makes the environment worse for everybody. I don't care. And what that's really saying is that they're not internalizing the well-being of others, that they don't feel a connection to others where they have that idea of that sense of interconnectedness, and that what they do to others impacts them. They don't have empathy for others when we dig down to that kind of level. And so I think littering is an interesting example of one of those outcomes of social capital. It doesn't involve direct exchanges, but from what we're talking about, clearly it's still very related to what social capital is.
And continuing with the discussion of littering, it's interesting how, as a public, we respond to that. On one hand, I drive down my highway and I see a sign that says a fine for littering, if you're caught, is $300 or whatever the amount is. And the sign is, I believe, intended to discourage others from littering by appealing to their potential economic losses. On the other hand, on this same highway, I find signs that say something like the this community's Rotary Club or some other group has adopted this highway for the next mile and a half. And on occasion, you'll drive down this stretch of highway and people will be there out there with litter bags collecting litter. And you say, wow, that's interesting. What motivates you? On the one hand, we have groups throwing it out, and you're out here voluntarily collecting it and doing the opposite. And the motives, at least from social capital theory, would be say, well, it's what my club does. I want to be part of it. So there is a joining motive. I feel it's the right thing to do, internal validation. Others may see me and say, oh, good for you, guy. And there's some external motivation. And I just care about nature. And so the motives we discuss in social capital theory can all manifest themselves in different ways in creating an externality. In the one case, a negative, in the other case, a positive one.
Yeah, and there's some interesting research that's come out of behavior change theories. I recall reading some years ago about some research done on protected areas where they would measure the amount of litter on the ground in a, say, the car park of a national park. And they would put, so they measured it when there was no signage, and then they put up a sign that said, fine for littering, $200 or something like that. The amount of litter increased once they put this sign up, not decreased. And then they changed the sign to people in this area do not litter and protect the environment, or something similar that implied a sense of belonging and connectedness with others and communicated a normative expectation of what others would do. And the amount of littering decreased significantly below the amount when there was no signage. And so this speaks to the nature of social capital and how our relationships do regulate externalities, because when we feel like we're connected with others, we're more likely to not do things that negatively impact others. And that's what social capital fundamentally is really all about.
I couldn't agree more. And when we emphasize social capital as whatever those emotions are, sympathy, empathy, trust, caring, regard, that lead us to internalize the well-being of others, the kinds of exchanges tend to be more pro-social than when they are not. And so we depend on social capital in ways that we're perhaps not really fully aware of, and reducing negative externalities or exchanges that produce negative consequences for others without their consent is an important role of social capital. And I think it needs to be included in our calculus of how we influence behavior, whether it's with a sign that threatens fines for misbehavior or offers relational goods for pro-social behavior.
Right. Because that's the other side of it, is that by saying that people don't litter here, it allows people to feel a sense of identity, or allows them to feel external validation perhaps by complying with that. And so it allows for the potential for the exchange of relational goods. Listen to me, I'm talking like you talk in terms of using these terminologies, like relational goods. But all the same, I think this is fundamentally, what social capital is about. And I really like the phrase you used a few weeks ago when you said that relationships alter motives. And so therefore it alters the motives that we have towards the nature of our exchanges. And I think that really, to me, that really puts the spotlight on how the way neoclassical economics theorizes exchanges needs to take into account the nature of relationships that then alter the motives of those exchanges. And that seems to be fundamentally what social capital is about, and the reason why we need a concept like social capital to understand that better.
There's perhaps one another area of exchange that we traditionally don't include. We surely don't include it in economics, but it's the role of competitive exchanges. For example, in the USA right now, we're approaching the National Basketball Association championship playoffs, and the two teams that have gone through rigorous competitive events are now facing off, and there are rules established for how this contest will be determined, and they will exchange in an event. And apart from agreeing to the same rules, they're each trying to impose their will or an outcome on their opponent. And in this competitive event occurs in so many of our settings, earning grades for school, competing for wages, for space and parking places, and so many things where there are well-established rules that we agree to, but we don't agree to accept, allow the other person to impose their will on us. And the outcome of those events can be diverse. You can have, on the one hand, teams unite because we want to belong to this effort to win the championship or the contest or the whatever, or the contract. That could be an outcome. It could be an outcome that we earn antipathy for our opponent because they're preventing our getting the championship, or it's maybe a test of my character, or if we win, we get more money or something. So we purposefully create exchanges to which are not, the outcome isn't mutually agreed to. It's not a, in some aspects there's agreement, but not on the outcome.
No, that's a fascinating other type of exchange. We've seen examples in marathons where competitors will help another competitor at the expense of their own time or their own result. But clearly there's some level of connectedness there. There's some empathy that they feel for the other competitor that compels them to take those actions. And I think you make a really great point too about, sporting teams and so many other areas of competition rely on agreement to abide by the rules and play in the fairness and spirit of the game, as it were. And that in itself is really a form or an outcome of social capital, because it's the ways in which they're connected and their respect and regard for others, even though they're competing with them and they want to beat them to get the outcome that they want for themselves. But they still have that agreement and they still have that connectedness with others in order to abide by the rules. And the outcome of that quite often is the sort of outcome I just described, that competitors will help other competitors at their own expense because they all see each other as together in the competition, even though they're being competitive.
That's, I've, you and I have both seen outcomes on a wide spectrum. In the one case, two competitors or teams that are competing develop antipathy, and we have sporting or fans taking aggressive behavior towards each other, versus the on the other extreme, the kind of outcome that you're describing. Empathy develops, social capital develops. We see where our commonality in trying to reach a goal, even though we're competitors, and we assist each other and act in ways that demonstrate we internalize each other. My one of my grandchildren was in a competitive event and did poorly, and the competitor came after the match, came across and gave her a hug, an expression of, cheer up, better luck next time, or something. And so it's the kind of relationship, the social capital, that really affects how we respond to the outcome of a competitive event. And maybe it's one of the reasons that you and I are so passionately committed to the concept of social capital, because the outcomes and the implications of social capital are so profound in so many different areas.
They really are. And that idea that all of the externalities of all of the different types of exchanges that we have are regulated by relationships, it speaks to just how profound social capital is. That if we have less or diminished or weakened social capital, then we're far more likely to get negative externalities from all of those exchanges that occur all day, every day. And that makes everybody worse off. And that speaks to just how significant and important social capital is for individuals and for groups and for society.
I think we're seeing off the same page.
Well, that's probably a good place to bring this episode to a close. As always, Lyndon, it's been great talking with you about this topic, and look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Tristan, and thank you all for joining us on this discussion. Look forward to seeing you next time.